Is there a sign, do you think, that the international community at some point is just going to have to accept North Korea as a nuclear power?
Well, as you know, Mary Louise, we're going to hear a lot of debate about this in the coming days. An ICBM would put Japan, South Korea, the United States in a much tougher negotiating position. And a lot of analysts have been saying North Korea has really reached a point where it's no longer realistic to go for that longstanding U.S. goal of denuclearizing North Korea, that instead the conversation should be about getting North Korea to a freeze to stop it from advancing its capabilities. I spoke with Melissa Hannum, a researcher with the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies. She says, given this difficult spot, it's time for efforts to really engage North Korea diplomatically.
We need to have really serious conversations amongst ourselves and with allies about what we're willing to trade. Because so far, there has been no price that was worth paying to stop their program.
And time is tight. This is a tough, tough problem for the international community.
Okay, that's NPR's Elise Hugh updating us on this latest missile test by North Korea. Elise, thank you.
You bet.
In this country, there are so many good ways to celebrate the 4th of July. At 3:55 this morning, some of our colleagues were making hot dogs and eating Tostitos, a sort of 4th of July picnic. There's so much news. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has signed a new budget which reopens the state government, including the state beach that he used while it was closed. We can also celebrate this country by having a political argument, and we are. Dozens of states have now rejected a Trump administration initiative. The Commission on Election Integrity asked every state for detailed information on every voter seeking evidence of fraud. Many states say they will not or cannot legally comply with the commission, which grew out of the president's sensitivity over losing the popular vote. NPR's Domenico Montanaro is here. Hi, Domenico.
Good morning, Steve.
What makes the state so resistant to providing the information?
Well, it's exactly the kind of information that they're asking for that makes them concerned. Chris Kobach, who's the former Secretary of State of the state of Kansas, wrote a letter to states asking for their input for the kinds of things like what kinds of changes they'd like made, how the commission can help support them. And then it goes on to ask what evidence they have of voter fraud. And they say that they're asking for voter roll data, dates of birth, political party, the last four digits of your Social Security number, mm-hmm. voter history, evidence of felony convictions, and notes that, you know, that people should be aware that any documents submitted to the commission would be made publicly available. And this is the kind of thing that a lot of states just said, wait a second, we don't want to put all of this information out there to be made public because we're not exactly sure what you're going to do with it.
Okay, so two things there. First, you mentioned voter fraud. That's a reminder that this commission grew out of the president's claim without evidence that he lost the popular vote because of millions of illegal votes, right?
That's absolutely true. He claimed that he lost by 3 million votes. There's absolutely no evidence that there's that kind of widespread fraud. There has been a commission that has been set up during the Bush administration, for example. It found hundreds of cases of voter fraud, but nothing on the scale of millions that would have tipped the balance in 2016.
And also, you said a lot of this information would be made public. Some of it is public, right? Is the concern just that it would all be put in one place?
You know, the concern is having that information out there. I mean, there's some federalism concerns. These states want to have their own control over the states, over their voter rolls within their states. And though part of that concern, obviously, is what the Trump administration is willing to do with that kind of information. Are they going to recommend purging people from voter rolls, for example?
Well, this argument will continue well after this Independence Day, no doubt. Domenico, thanks very much. Enjoy the holiday.
You're welcome. Same to you.
Two things we know. Interest rates are low. Consumer confidence is high, which means the housing market should be hot. But it is not. It's just okay. NPR's Chris Arnold has been asking why.
Here's something you might not realize. 25 years ago, Americans were more than twice as likely to pick up and move from one state to another. Greg Kaplan is an economist at the University of Chicago.
To me, this is a huge move. It's a huge difference in how people are moving around the country today than they did a generation ago.
Kaplan's research suggests that a central reason for this change is that people don't have to move as much to find a good job that matches their skills.
It used to be the case that if computer science was your thing and you wanted to be a software engineer, the best place for you to reap a return on those skills was to go to Silicon Valley. Now, that's probably still true today. It's just less true than it used to be.
So Kaplan says if you want to live in Kansas City or Phoenix, maybe to stay close to friends and family, there's a more diverse range of job opportunities in more parts of the country.
What we call the decline in geographic specificity of occupations basically means you can do everything everywhere. That's a good thing.
Or, okay, you can't do everything everywhere, but today we have more options. Some housing experts, though, think that this also might be part of what's stunting the housing market. William Wheaton is a housing economist with MIT.
There's a lot of discussion right now about how sales should be more robust, and they're not, given where we are in the stage of the economic recovery.
Wheaton says Americans are buying the same number of homes that they were 18 years ago. The population has grown since then, so he says sales should be stronger. There are many things going on here. Young people, for one, are taking longer to settle down, get married, buy their first house, but also...
A large part of the activity in the housing market is what we think of as churn. So this is people who are buying one house and selling another. Churn is down quite a lot.
Wheaton says part of this might be because of what Greg Kaplan describes. It also might be...
People are still gun-shy. They're just, you know, they have a decent job. They don't want to push it and risk losing that job by spending a lot of time searching for a new job.
And even when home sales do go through these days, you can sometimes see some of the other problems that are slowing down the market.
So right now we're standing in our living room, which is also somewhat of a sea of boxes because we're moving.
Allie Milburn has been renting this apartment with her husband outside Cleveland. Now the couple has just bought a house with more space. It's nearby in a nice neighborhood. One of these boxes is full of gardening tools.
And the house has a really nice backyard. We're kind of just excited, I think, to finally like be able to play house for real.
But buying this house almost didn't happen. Milburn says the couple just wasn't finding many good houses to choose from.
We were kind of to the point where we were almost done, I think, like just frustrated because we just weren't finding things.
Realtors say a tight supply of homes is a problem in a lot of places. And that gets back to the low churn rate that Wheaton talked about. Fewer people selling their houses to buy other houses. Also, Wheaton says in many parts of the country, home prices still haven't risen back to or much above their peaks from the housing bubble. So many people still haven't built up much equity in their homes. In that sense, he says the market's still recovering, but it's not recovered yet.
And you got to be recovered before people are sitting on top of little nest eggs of equity and can say, oh, you know, now we can go buy the house down the street we always wanted.
And that, in the end, may be the biggest drag on housing right now. We just still haven't quite gotten over the hangover from the worst housing crash since the Great Depression. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
And on this Independence Day, it's 8:18. This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Up next, we'll bring you news live from NPR and WPR. We'll take a look at the employment rate among people with disabilities in Wisconsin. WPR's Rich Kramer breaks down that story in a few minutes.
Support for WGTD in Walworth County comes from Music by the Lake in Williams Bay, welcoming New Orleans-style jazz with the Preservation Hall Jazz Band, Sunday, July 16th, 4 p.m. Tickets are going fast. To get yours, visit musicbythelake.com.
Madison Central Park. WPR is pleased to support musical and cultural connections. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Barbara Klein. The U.S., Japan, and South Korea are condemning North Korea over today's ballistic missile test, the 11th this year. From Tokyo, John Matthews reports the missile appears to be more advanced than previous ones.
South Korean and Japanese officials say the intermediate-range ballistic missile flew 580 miles, the furthest for North Korean tests of that class of missile, before falling in the Sea of Japan. The new missile has, quote, greater capability, according to Japan's chief government spokesperson. He, however, gave few details beyond suggesting it reached a higher altitude than previous missiles.
The U.S.-led coalition in Syria says it's made a major advance against ISIS in Raqqa, which the Islamic State considers its capital. Syrian forces say they've breached the wall around the heavily fortified old city. President Trump is preparing to head to Europe tomorrow for a G20 summit in Germany. From Berlin, NPR's Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson reports the president has called his German and Italian counterparts to talk in advance of the meeting.
The White House says Trump held extensive discussions with the leaders and that they addressed climate issues, financing for women's business projects, and trade. President Trump and Chancellor Merkel will resume their conversation on Thursday in Hamburg on the eve of the G20 summit. But the meeting could prove contentious, given their differing views about climate change.
I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. New data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics shows the employment rate for people with disabilities improved last year. But as Rich Kramer reports, advocates in Wisconsin say their clients are still underutilized in the workforce.
Survey results show nearly 18% of people with a disability in the U.S. were employed in 2016. The rate improved slightly compared with data from the year before, but it's still far behind the 65% unemployment rate for those without disabilities. Beth Swedeen is the executive director for the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities.
We have to focus our public policies more directly at supporting people with disabilities to get into work that's a good match for them and then make sure that they're supported to learn the job and maintain it.
Swedeen points to Dane County as a model with 60% employment for those with disabilities. Statewide, the employment rate is 20%. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The National Weather Service says it has confirmed a third tornado from last week's storms in southern Wisconsin. The Weather Service says the EF0 tornado touched down Wednesday evening in Rock County near Janesville. It had estimated peak winds of 80 miles per hour, with a path about 100 yards wide and 8/10 a mile long. The EF0 tornado is the weakest on a scale that goes up to EF5. Two other tornadoes touched down on Wednesday in Greene County. Another one touched down in Pierce County. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from DiscountMugs.com, with online design tools to enable individuals and businesses to print their message or logo on a variety of items, including drinkware, tote bags, and clothing. Learn more at DiscountMugs.com/NPR. From Whole Foods Market, offering 4th of July staples for barbecues and picnics, such as meats, side dishes, and desserts. Ideas for 4th of July entertaining are available at WholeFoodsMarket.com. Whole Foods Market, we believe in real food. And from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, working to unleash the immune system's power to fight cancer and develop promising new therapies. Videos, white papers, and patient stories are available at discovercarebelieve.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Steve Inskeep, here to ask Koki about the Declaration of Independence on this Independence Day. We regularly ask Koki Roberts how politics and Washington work, and now we're going to ask about how politics worked in the days before there was a Washington, D.C., how American leaders arrived at the document that declares that all men are created equal. Hi, Koki.
Hi, Steve.
So it's 1776, I guess, as we all learn in school, but the Revolutionary War actually started a year or so before that, right?
Right, of course, the battles of Concord and Lexington, April 19, 1775. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of fighting going on. Massachusetts was really under siege. But the men meeting in Philadelphia, who were members of the Continental Congress, who had been sent by every colony to mm-hmm. try to rule the non-country, were debating whether to stay close to Great Britain or to declare independence. And they really didn't want to get there very easily because, of course, if they declared independence, they were traitors. They were treasonous. They could be hanged.
So we have a question of politics here because you have different people from different states all in a room with different interests and also with their necks on the line, I guess.
Exactly. Now, some states, like North Carolina, were adamant that they wanted at least some separation from the king. And they have what was called the Mecklenburg Resolutions, where they sent a man by horseback to Philadelphia in 1775 to say that the laws of Great Britain were null and void. But the Continental Congress in July 1775 not only was not accepting that, they were still sending a peace offering to the king, the Olive Branch Petition. And Steve, that's signed by most of the same guys who signed the Declaration of Independence, including Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, John Adams. And I can tell you that did not sit well at all with Mrs. Adams. She was furious.
This has got to feel familiar to you, Cokie, as someone who has covered politics in more modern times, because you have an actual shooting war. You have what seems like a desperate, urgent situation, but you have a Congress that's working its way through debates and half measures and trying to kind of talk the problem away if they can.
And some of the women were simply not having it. Abigail Adams, who was in the middle of all the fighting, even before Lexington and Concord, she said Americans would rather die the last of British freemen than bear to live as the first of British slaves.
I appreciate you reminding us that women are part of this debate, but of course they weren't in the room. In the end, it's a few dozen men in a room in Philadelphia. How did they then approach the actual declaration that we now know and hear about every July 4th?
So they finally did, on July 2nd, by the way, 1776, approve the Declaration of Independence and then made it public on July 4th. But they had to escape Philadelphia pretty fast, Steve, because the British were coming. And by January 1777, they were ready to promulgate it with everybody's signatures on it. And they went to the most respected printer in Baltimore, and she typeset the Declaration of Independence and put her own name, Mary Catherine Goddard Printer, at the bottom. Wow. So she, too, was a signer. She, too, was treasonous. She, too, could have been hanged.
So when you think about that story and the different clashing interests and the year or more that it took them to get on the same page about independence, what does it tell you about politics today?
It tells you that compromise is what is necessary. People have to talk it out and get to a point where they can agree. But it's also true that crisis makes a big difference, and there was a crisis.
Although even when there's a crisis, it might take an extra year or so.
That's true.
Cokie, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve. Happy 4th.
You too. Commentator Cokie Roberts.
Tonight, as it has for years, the Boston Pops will play Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture. Then an intricate fireworks show will launch from barges in the middle of the Charles River between Boston and Cambridge. A huge audience will be watching in person on TV and streaming online. As part of our Backstage Pass series, WBUR's Jeremy Goodwin went on board the barge to preview how it will all work.
A crew of about a dozen workers is on three barges, setting up for the big night. They are sawing planks of wood and hammering together racks for empty mortars or metal tubes. That's where the firework shells are loaded in. When night falls, state troopers will be stationed on the barges to keep watch. No one else is allowed within 1,000 feet. Fireworks by Grucci is the company that pulls off the show. Lauren Grucci is the sixth generation of her family in the business. She's writing with a black marker on strips of masking tape and carefully sticking them onto the wooden racks of mortars.
I'm labeling each one so that everybody knows which shell to put in which spot. It's all choreographed to music, so they need to know, you know, each one of these are gonna go off at a very specific time, so it all needs to be numbered so that it's clear.
Her father, Phil, is the creative maestro behind the fireworks show. When the time comes, he'll be running the controls inside a metal box on one of the barges. He spent hours working with Boston Pops conductor Keith Lockhart to plan out a song list, then designed a fireworks display that will boom, crackle, and explode in sync with the tunes. The basic technology behind fireworks goes back to China, as far as 2,000 years ago. But the guy who's overseeing the setup out here on the barges, Ian McKenzie, says the newest equipment on board nowadays creates a pinpoint level of control unheard of previously.
Launches a single star, these very specially refined stars, out of a long mortar tube.
We can spell out letters, we can draw shapes, we can do all sorts of... We've done that in various other performances around the world.
Mackenzie won't say what's in store tonight.
I'm going to leave that part as a surprise. You'll see, you'll know it when you see it.
In addition to folks watching on TV and the internet, about 500,000 people will line both sides of the Charles River tonight to find out in person. For NPR News, I'm Jeremy Goodwin in Boston.
This is NPR News.
On Independence Day, there are lots of fireworks shows with orchestral accompaniment. The one in Nashville takes things to another level, with a maestro calling the shots live.
The 1812 Overture is probably the most fun because of all those cannons. You know, we try to reproduce the sound of the howitzers that were actually written in the original song.
I'm Ari Shapiro, July 4th in style, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story plus music on All Things Considered, which airs from 4 to 6:30 today here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And still to come this hour on Morning Edition, new research shows that birth order really does matter. Compared to their older siblings, second-born boys are much more likely to end up in prison, get suspended in school, and enter juvenile delinquency. Find out why in about 15 minutes. It is 8:30 on this Independence Day. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Maureen McCollum. In Wisconsin news, the medical examiner's office says 18 people in Milwaukee have died of overdoses this year involving a fentanyl derivative that's so potent it can require higher doses of an opioid antidote to counteract it. The deaths come as the Drug Enforcement Administration prepares to label acrylfentanyl as a Schedule I drug, which would classify the drug as having a high potential for abuse. The overdoses also highlight a troubling increase in the number of deaths related to fentanyl or synthetic fentanyl in Milwaukee. This year, 59 overdoses have involved fentanyl. That puts the county on pace to exceed the 97 deaths related to the drug last year. Police say DNA evidence has led to the arrest of one of two suspects in an armed robbery at a Madison Culver's restaurant that left a contractor dead. Authorities say a 32-year-old man was arrested without incident on Friday in Janesville. Madison police had previously called him a person of interest. He was being held yesterday on suspicion of felony murder and armed robbery. Police are still looking for a second suspect in the robbery-turned-homicide. Police say 56-year-old Chris Kennebuhl of Twin Lakes was working on a remodeling project at the restaurant early last week when the masked robbers entered. Police say he suffered a heart attack after robbers forced him to use equipment to open a safe. This is WPR.
Support for WPR comes from the Flower Factory Nursery in Stoughton, featuring 11 greenhouses filled with thousands of perennials, growing a variety of daylilies, ornamental grasses, coneflowers, and more. TheFlowerFactoryNursery.com.
Support for WGTD comes from Carthage College, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad.
Sunny day across Wisconsin. Temperatures will range from the upper 60s in the north to the 80s in the west.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Baird, employee-owned and independent. Baird has kept clients' financial interests first since 1919. RWBaird.com has more information. From Barracuda Networks, security, data protection, and application delivery solutions for physical networks and public cloud services. Learn more at barracuda.com/products. And from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs who work to solve the world's most pressing problems. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Good morning. In Italy, more than 12,000 migrants arrived at ports last week. There's been a 20% increase in the flow of migrants into Italy this year over the same period last year, more than 85,000 arrivals. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees calls it an unfolding tragedy as the country struggles with the costs and the logistics of caring for all these people. Most of Italy's European Union partners are are not responding to appeals to share the burden. Well, NPR's Sylvia Poggioli joins us on the line now. Good morning, Sylvia.
Good morning.
What exactly is Italy asking other European countries to do to help?
Well, last week, Italy threatened to close its ports to ships owned by humanitarian aid groups, the NGOs, non-governmental organizations, that are currently rescuing some 40% of the migrants crossing the Mediterranean. That led to a meeting Sunday in Paris of the interior ministers of Italy, France, and Germany, and the EU Migration Commissioner. Now, some estimates say that 220,000 migrants could arrive in Italy by the end of this year. So Italian Prime Minister Paolo Gentiloni asked for help in preventing the flows, as he said, from becoming unsustainable and feeding hostile reactions within our social fabric.
Wow, 220,000 migrants that could arrive this year. Just huge numbers that Italy is trying to grapple with. How are other countries reacting to the plea for some help there?
Not very well. The other two countries rejected outright Italy's request that some of the migrant arrivals be disembarked in other European ports, such as Marseille in France and Barcelona in Spain. They also rejected the idea of a European central command for search and rescue operations. Now, Rome is particularly disappointed with the French president, Emmanuel Macron, who said last week that France would help migrants who are escaping war, those who are eligible for asylum, but not so-called economic migrants. Italian commentators point out that many of those migrants come from former French colonies in Africa.
I guess one question is what kind of leverage Italy has in these negotiations. Did Italy manage to get anything out of these talks you were describing in Paris?
Well, France and Germany did agree to step up the relocation of asylum seekers from Italy across the EU, but it's really not clear how they can do that because in 2015, the EU had set up a quota system for each country, but it was a flop because the East Europeans, that's Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, and Slovakia, simply refused to take migrants in even at the risk of heavy fines imposed by the EU. And now France and Germany also agreed to increase economic support for the Coast Guard in Libya to help curb the human traffickers on Libyan coast, as well as more funds to help secure Libya's southern border, which is the migrants' main point of entry from sub-Saharan Africa. But those are not short-term solutions.
That's NPR's Sylvia Poggioli. Thanks so much.
Okay, now in this country, one of the few things politicians agree on is that the United States needs to do a better job retraining workers. President Trump recently declared a Workforce Development Week, but a program that was supposed to retrain hundreds of former Los Angeles hotel workers shows that it can be hard just to get people to show up. Here's Ben Bergman of our member station KPCC.
For decades, the Century Plaza was one of LA's most iconic hotels. Guests included presidents from Lyndon Johnson to Bill Clinton. But last year, the hotel closed and hundreds of longtime workers were let go, including Judith Raimundo.
For me, it's a dream job working in that facility for 20 years.
Even though she rarely met guests face-to-face, she felt like she knew them and she was making their day better taking room service orders.
I thought I'm going to retire in this job. And after the 20 years, you get old and suddenly you start all over again. And it's hard.
To help ease the transition, Raimundo and her former colleagues were offered extensive retraining thanks to an $800,000 state grant awarded to the city of L.A. There were resume and interviewing workshops, barista training, and a class on how to serve guests.
We have to be able to work smart, quick. Time is money.
Instructor Joanna Hume showed a group of former workers how to delicately balance champagne flutes between their fingers.
Let's see if my experienced staff, how many they can get. Come on.
The goal of the grant was to get workers up to speed on the latest dining and hospitality trends so they could be competitive in the job market. Aideen Foreman oversaw the trainings.
As food tastes have grown and evolved, so we need to make the workers evolve as well.
But that evolution has proven difficult. After a year, just 169 out of about 600 full-time employees have found new jobs, even as several new L.A. hotels have opened. The program's goal was for a 70% rehire rate. It met that goal by only counting the number who signed up for retraining rather than the number who were laid off. Foreman says it's not fair to count those who didn't show up.
Usually when there's a mass layoff like this, people just sort of scatter to the wind, and it's really hard to find them and for them to figure out where to get help.
Chef Mitchell Frieder taught a cooking course, and he's baffled as to why more people didn't take advantage of training that didn't cost them anything. He says when he used to teach a similar class at a for-profit college, the tuition was $38,000.
This program is the entire first term from that school for free. I can't imagine why we don't have thousands of people in line to come in for this program right now. It's the oddest thing.
So I asked Frieder, why wasn't there a line out the door?
Unknown. Can't imagine.
The low turnout rate is hardly unique, according to Joseph Perilla. He studies worker retraining at the Brookings Institution.
The reality is that retraining is very difficult.
Perilla says it can be tough to convince laid-off workers that training will pay off for them and they'll be able to land a new job, especially for older workers.
The calculus around investing in a new skill set and changing careers looks a lot different if you're 30 years old versus 60 years old.
Perilla suspects turnout would have been better if the program provided transportation and childcare. But all of that, of course, takes money, and the U.S. spends just a fraction of the amount other industrialized countries do on worker retraining.
Until we start to deal with that lack of investment, we're going to continue to have this challenging conversation about the quality of these programs and the outcomes that they can deliver.
Though in the case of the hotel program, funding doesn't seem to have been an issue. In fact, so few workers showed up that the city only spent $180,000 of the $800,000 awarded by the state. For NPR News, I'm Ben Bergman in Los Angeles.
And later this afternoon, and All Things Considered, we'll tell you how some libraries are adapting to an aging population by catering to senior citizens. This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:41. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next on this Independence Day, it's news live from NPR and WPR. And in 10 minutes on Morning Edition, there's always that one summer song that's a breakout hit. What will it be for summer of 2017? Some music experts break down their picks for us. Hear if your favorites made the list in 10 minutes.
I'm Paul Ganchert from Ganchert Nursery and Landscapes in Madison here, and we donated an old 99 Dodge pickup truck with 240,000 miles. I typically drove it because I didn't want anybody else driving it. It had had a pretty long, rough life and didn't owe us a nickel, but we eventually donated that, and that process was so good. We had two larger trucks. We had quite an issue trying to sell them and whatever else, and I thought, well, if anybody's going to benefit, I'd rather have you guys benefit.
Find out how you can donate your old vehicle. Go to WPR.org/support and thank you.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Barbara Klein. Russia and China are calling on North Korea to freeze its missile and nuclear program and on the U.S. to stop its deployment of a missile shield in South Korea. All this comes in response to today's ballistic missile test by Pyongyang. New Jersey's budget crisis is over, as is the state's three-day partial government shutdown. Early this morning, Governor Chris Christie signed a budget.
This bill is a long overdue, significant reform that will have a lasting impact on New Jersey residents.
The deal struck with the Democratic legislature does not include Christie's demand that the state be given control over New Jersey's largest health insurer. As cities and towns prepare for Independence Day fireworks this evening, the Federal Aviation Administration is issuing a warning to amateur drone owners hoping to take aerial photos and videos of the displays. NPR's Alina Selyuk reports the FAA says quadcopters should keep their distance.
The FAA has published a reminder for amateur drone pilots. The safety rules say you should not fly drones over people or higher than 400 feet. You should always be able to see your drone, and you shouldn't fly drones in the dark. Experts also always recommend checking with state and local authorities and event organizers for rules in the specific area.
Wall Street is closed today for the Independence Day holiday. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. Wisconsin is one of nine states that spend more than half their Medicaid funds keeping elderly and disabled out of nursing homes. According to a recent national report by AARP, other states are making slower progress on caring for people in the community. Shemaine Mills reports.
Wisconsin has always been a leader on issues related to aging, says Helen Marks-Dix. She's the State Issues Advocacy Director for AARP Wisconsin.
Right now, covering people in nursing homes is mandatory, but the states have the option whether to do home and community-based services, and we've always taken that option.
Dix says that could change if Medicaid funding is cut under the Republican health plan being debated in Washington. According to the AARP report, Minnesota spent the greatest percentage of Medicaid dollars on community-based services for the elderly and disabled, 69% in 2014. Wisconsin spent 53%. Shimei Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The head of Didion Milling has told the Cambria Village Board that the mill building, which exploded, killing five workers in May, will be demolished next week. CEO John Didion says the mill building will be rebuilt with the best available technology for safety, automation, and efficiency. OSHA is still evaluating the scene as it tries to determine the exact cause of the explosion.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. From Inada, creators of the Japanese-made Dreamwave massage chair, with shiatsu point detection and 16 programmed massages, including morning and nighttime sessions. Retail dealers nationwide. More at dreamwavechair.com. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. You've heard the stereotypes. Firstborn children are spoiled, middle kids get ignored, and the youngest kids act out because they crave attention. Well, new research shows that birth order really does matter. NPR's social science correspondent Shankar Vedantam spoke with our co-host David Green.
Hey, Shankar.
Hey, David.
So, Shankar, the effective birth order, it's a real thing. It's not just a cliche or fodder for jokes that, you know, people can make at their siblings' expense.
That's right, David. A number of studies have looked into this, and they found that firstborns often do better than secondborns on many fronts, everything from educational attainment to test scores, IQ, wages, even labor market outcomes.
So maybe the spoiled part is not true, but they actually it does make a difference in some ways.
Exactly.
But, I mean, Shankar, you did give a long list of advantages there for firstborns. Is this research new, stuff we didn't know before?
There is new research now, David. It comes from Joseph Doyle. He's an MIT economist, and he looks not at positive stuff, but negative stuff. Violent crime, delinquency, school suspensions. His research focuses on boys, since boys are much more likely than girls to end up in serious trouble in their teenage years. Doyle and his colleagues, Sani Brining, David Figlio, Chris Carbonic, and Jeffrey Roth, got their hands on large data sets, David, involving tens of thousands of brothers. Now, because you're comparing older brothers against younger brothers, you can assume the family environment for both kids is more or less constant. The data come from two very different settings, the state of Florida and the country of Denmark. Lots of things are different in those two places, but the researchers find consistent evidence when it comes to crime and delinquency.
I find the results to be remarkable, that the second-born children compared to their older siblings are much more likely to end up in prison, much more likely to get suspended in school, enter juvenile delinquency. Across all these outcomes, we're getting 25 to 40% increases in the likelihood of these outcomes just by comparing a second-born sibling compared to a first-born.
To be clear, David, only a minority of kids, maybe, you know, 1 in 10, 1 in 20, are getting in serious trouble. But Doyle is saying that among this minority of children, there appear to be sizable differences between first- and second-born brothers.
Well, why are there these big differences between younger and older children, does he think?
Well, one possible explanation has to do with the effect of parental time and investment. As many other earlier studies have noted, first-born kids get the undivided attention of their parents, whereas kids born later are often competing for parental time and resources. Another factor that might be different is the peer group for first and second-born kids is different. Older and younger siblings come from the same family, but they have different peer groups early in life.
The firstborn has role models who are adults, and the second and later-born children have role models who are slightly irrational two-year-olds, you know, their older siblings. Both the parental investments are different and the sibling influences probably contribute to these differences we see in labor market and what we find in delinquency. It's just very difficult to separate those two things because they happen at the same time.
I should say here, David, for all the people who are throwing objects at the radio or about to hurl their phone off a tall building, birth order effects tend to be very controversial because everyone immediately thinks about their own sibling relationships or their own children, and we all tend to draw conclusions about our immediate family experiences. This research, of course, is painting a broad picture. It doesn't describe what's happening in every single family.
Okay. Good to remind people of that. Thanks, Shankar.
Thank you, David.
That is Shankar Vedantam. He is NPR's social science correspondent. You also hear him frequently on this program, and he hosts a podcast that explores the unseen patterns in human behavior. It's called Hidden Brain.
Support for Hidden Brain comes from Eli Lilly and Company, striving to unite caring with discovery to make life better. Stories on what inspires Lilly scientists in their pursuit of life-changing medicines to treat breast cancer is available at lillyforbetter.com. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock on this 4th of July holiday. Thank you so much for beginning it with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Morning Classics kicks off in about 15 minutes. Today, Peter Bryant is filling in for Stephanie Elkins, and he'll play you music featuring several pieces for Independence Day, including Copland's Lincoln Portrait, narrated by Maya Angelou. Stay tuned for classical music after headlines at 9 o'clock here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus, honoring personal legacies and the circle of life. Allow the compassionate, caring staff at Piasecki Althaus to take care of your funeral needs, serving the community since 1931.
On the air, NPR speaks in a voice you trust, and then we trust you to speak for yourself. This is NPR.
Should be mostly sunny across Wisconsin today. Highs will range from the upper 60s near Superior. It'll be in the mid-70s around Milwaukee, and it'll be in the upper 80s in the La Crosse area. Tonight, chance of thunderstorms.
Support for WPR comes from Steep & Brew, dedicated to being a socially and environmentally responsible company. Rooftop solar panels now generate 80% of electricity. A greener cup of coffee. Steepandbrew.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, author Charlie Donnelly will be presenting a book talk and signing at the Lake Geneva Public Library on Friday, July 7th at 6:30 p.m. to kick off Beachside Author Fest. Visit the library website for more information and events.
On this Independence Day, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inske.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. That was the song of the summer way back in 1963.
And this was the song of the summer in 1979.
Love me some Donna Summer. Okay, fast forward now, 2002.
Do we have to? Oh, it's getting hot in here. So hot. All right, every summer has at least one song that burrows into your mind and never really lets go.
Which brings us to this, what's going to be the song of the summer 2017. We asked a few of our favorite music obsessives to weigh in.
Hi, I'm Felix Contreras. I'm the host of Alt Latino, and I want to talk about one of the songs of summer, Despacito.
Ay. Fonzie! Diwa!
Oh! This song is special for a lot of reasons. One of the reasons is that it will bring attention, I think, to Luis Fonsi, to an audience that has not exactly been aware of him in the past. Luis Fonsi is from Puerto Rico and is a very, very popular singer. And Daddy Yankee, who is a rapper and reggaeton artist. And they're coming together on this sort of crossover hit that draws elements from reggaeton, but also features Luis Fonsi's very, very seductive voice, I guess you could say. Now, the original version of the song was already popular on Spanish language radio, and this one is notable because it's a remix with Justin Bieber, and he has recorded a part in the song where he learned the lyric phonetically to mix in with the parts that are already there with Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee. This is one of those once-in-a-decade things. Los Lobos had La Bamba, a number one hit in the 80s. There was the infamous Macarena in the 1990s. And this is another example of a Spanish-language song becoming number one on the pop charts. I can guarantee you, after hearing it this morning, you're going to be humming it to yourself all day long. And even if you've never heard it before, it's a blessing and a curse in a way.
This song sort of commands the enjoyment of summer, almost in an instructional sort of way. Like 10 seconds in, there's this sound that's like buried under the guitar that sounds like you've just taken a sip of the greatest margarita in the entire world. Hey, I'm Talia Schlanger. I host the World Cafe, and my song of summer choice is Jay Boy by the band Phoenix. Something in the middle of the side of the storm. Got your attention and asked for more. I was excited to be part of your world, to belong, to be loved, but mostly to do. Phoenix is a band that's based in Paris, but they've sung in English since the very beginning of their careers. And they've talked before about how that gives them access to this sort of second language charm. The appeal, I guess, of not singing in your native tongue and having things be a little bit more poetic. J-Boy is the title of the song, and it stands for Just Because of You. And the album and this song are full of that like feeling of fresh, young love that is also so evocative of warm weather and summer. And the guys came into World Cafe and we talked about that young love feel on this album. And I asked them how they managed to summon it, because these are all guys who are in long-term relationships, who have got kids. And the lead singer, Tomat, looked at me straight in the eye and said, I believe that love is always fresh. And maybe it's because he's French, but I really believe him when he says it. And that is summer.
My name is Rodney Carmichael. I am a hip-hop reporter here at NPR. And my choice for Song of the Summer is by Gucci Mane, featuring Chris Brown. And the name of the song is Tone It Down.
Tell me who can ball like this. Huh? Pull up, froze up with the toe up. Chop it in the club, don't care who show up. Watch looking like a glow up. Wanna throw up, east side, pull the bridge, bro, why grow up?
Gucci Mane is Atlanta's trap god, so to speak. Trap is a subgenre of hip-hop that he has pretty much owned for the better part of a decade. He got out of prison. He talked about how prison really helped him because it gave him a chance to clean up. And he's been on a pretty successful tear. Gucci Mane and Chris Brown together, I mean, both of their careers to some extent have suffered from self-sabotage. But both have battled back to get back some of that squandered promise that they showed early on as artists. For that reason, I think it's pretty unique pairing to have both of them side by side.
Tell me who can ball like this. Go! Gucci Mane and CB, you're really 3D, trying to be like me, ain't easy. Take me, women wanna date.
Earlier this year, we had a lot of hip-hop songs that had this pop-friendly flute sound. Gucci really attempts to capitalize on this flute craze. It sounds like top-down summer trap music.
I'm Gwen Tompkins, host of the public radio program Music Inside Out in New Orleans. And the song Here Come the Girls is having a very good summer in our city. The version that we're listening to is by Trombone Shorty, who is a local hero here, and he heads a band called Trombone Shorty and Orleans Avenue. And they decided to record this song, which is an old song, actually, by Alan Toussaint, who was the great sort of impresario down here in New Orleans. Trombone Shorty, you know, people around the country might know him by a television show that he appeared in, which was HBO's Tremé.
You're looking so good as a doggone shame that they all couldn't be mine. You're looking so pretty as a doggone pity. Oh, you're looking so fine.
Let's face it. I mean, it's a song about a leering guy who loves to look at women and he wants all of them, every last one of them. But what's interesting about the song is that it's been appropriated to some degree by women who love the chorus.
Here come the girl.
It just is a booty-shaking anthem to be in New Orleans.
All right, there you have it. Four contenders for 2017 Song of the Summer.
Just four. So if you're busy screaming at the radio right now, what about DJ Khaled? How could you not play Bruno Mars or Ed Sheeran?
I'm going to throw in Lorde there or Selena Gomez. Maybe put a few women on the table.
Let us have it. We're at Morning Edition on Twitter.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Happy 4th of July wherever you are. We hope you're dancing. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
More news coming up this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR at 4 o'clock. And just before that, the BBC NewsHour at 3. Learn more about our schedule at WPR.org.
Support for WPR comes from the University of Wisconsin Survey Center, committed to advancing science through innovative data collection and study design, providing web, mail, and in-person research methods. UWSC.wisc.edu.
Support for WGTD comes from Andrea's. It's patio season, which means al fresco dining at Jack's Cafe. Stop by and enjoy the sun along with one of their breezy summer cafe specials. Updated daily at andreasgifts.com.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.